Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Arthur C. Brooks, who's the president of the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the new book, The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nick.
You open the book with a chapter about the 70-30 nation. What is the 70-30 nation?
The 70-30 nation is all about the contours in public opinion between the people who like the free enterprise system culturally and the people who reject the free enterprise system culturally. So one of the things that you find is that most Americans don't see free enterprise as just an economic matter. They see it as kind of a lifestyle issue. They see it as the bedrock of American culture. And that's about 70% of the population. You go out there and you ask people, do you believe that the free markets are the best way to organize our economy despite severe ups and downs?
Right.
7 in 10 say yes. About 20% say no, and 10% evidently don't understand the question.
Who are the people who don't? The 30% who are the people who don't like free enterprise? And what form? And actually, let's take it back a step. Define free enterprise.
Well, free enterprise is it's the manifestation of the freedoms that our founders talked about. So our founders talked about making the freest nation in the world, and how do you have to express that in some way?
Right.
And the way that we express that in our workaday world is a system that limits government, that uses free markets to allocate rewards and consequences of behavior, and one that's not overly concerned with income distribution. It doesn't favor leveling, and that's in stark contrast to European-style social democracy, which has a large and growing government, which believes in a managed economy, and has as its principal aspect something that its big goal is making sure that people are more or less equal in how much they take from the economy.
Is that actually true of Europe in two ways, and then let's talk about America. But first off, in most of the OECD countries, until the current fiscal crisis, GDP or government expenditures as a percentage of GDP had actually been declining for about 10 years or 15 years. But then also, Europe clearly has class stratification. Mm-hmm. Is it accurate to say they want people to be equal, or do they just want to provide a much more robust safety net?
Well, that's always what they say. Yeah. I mean, when you talk to Europeans, they say this all the time, that what we really want is to make sure there's an adequate level of support.
That there are no homeless people.
We don't want to be stepping over starving people like you bad guys in the United States do, and that sort of thing. You hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. But in point of fact, when you look at the goals that European social democrats have, and the reason that they favor a really high progressive tax system is because they think that it's not right, it's not fair for some people to earn so much more than other people. And generally speaking, when they make these arguments, when the left-wing parties in Europe make these arguments, they point to the United States and say, see, CEOs make 754,000 times more than the average worker in these types of arguments.
So the 30%, who are the leaders of the 30%ers in the U.S.?
Well, they're people in the idea business, basically. They're people who are above average income, above average education in idea industries like law, journalism, entertainment, public policy frequently. They're writers, they're artists, they're people that are opinion leaders, basically, who are generally speaking doing pretty well economically and have high education levels.
Now, and one of the things that you note in the book is that you talk about how the right generally, or among the what you call the non-intellectual upper class, has trended conservative since the 1970s, but upper class liberals have gone left at a rate of about 20-fold since 1972. What would explain that? I mean, because basically what you're talking about is if you have wealthy conservatives and wealthy liberals, liberals are getting a lot more left-wing over the past 40 years?
Yeah, it's not just liberals. It's basically people in the idea business. And so you find upper income, upper education people in idea industries have trended way, way, way left.
What explains that?
Well, this is a cultural issue. I mean, basically you get these cultural enclaves going, and you find that people in particular industries and in particular cultural groups will take more or less the same level of politics. And so you find, for example, academics. If you go back to the 40s, the 30s and 40s, there were radicals in academia, radical leftists in academia, but it was nothing like today where there's a standard canon. I mean, if you're an academic in good standing, generally speaking, you have a certain set of very liberal political beliefs.
And it might be that my background's in literary studies, but I go back to one of the opening statements in Lionel Trilling's The Liberal Imagination, where he says, which came out in the early 40s, and he said, you know what, I would actually engage conservative ideas, by which he meant non-liberal ideas, if in fact there were any, but there aren't. And then 10 years later, you would have somebody like Richard Hofstadter writing in Anti-Intellectualism, saying, spending the first five pages of the book talking about how Bill Buckley isn't an intellectual, and so there's nobody on the right worth debating.
Right.
Period. I mean, isn't this a longer-lived kind of solipsism among the you know, the elites in America.
Well, the elites have always had this conceit of the anointed, mm-hmm. that this the liberals in general have this conceit of the anointed, that since they have values that are contrary to what a lot of Americans embrace, therefore in a weird sort of parallel world, they must axiomatically be right, and so they can impose them on others if they simply have sufficient power. That's right. The idea. But you do go back five decades, mm-hmm. and you find that it was much more normal to see people of mainstream political and economic views on college campuses. And mm-hmm. what effectively happened was that radicals were able to colonize, culturally colonize college campuses, such that people that were getting most of the PhDs and staying on college campuses had these mainstream, for them, mainstream views, which are very non-mainstream by American standards.
Now, at the same level, a friend of mine once said, you know, who's from the left, he said, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to the left is they gain control of the college campuses because all they're doing is turning out graduates who get more and more right. So, you know, you give them the professoriate and, you know, the right gets everything else. Yeah. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, there is truth to that. There's actually even a greater irony than that, which is that when you look at the data on college graduates, I mean, everybody's mm-hmm. super paranoid about, you know, what's going to happen when your kids go to college.
Right.
So you've got a college-age kid, you know, you're worried that your kid's going to go to a college and suddenly turn into some sort of raving communist, right? Well, the data say no. The data say that the people who are in most danger of flipping politically are people that come from liberal households, mm-hmm. go to college, and by their late 30s, they're more likely to be voting for mm-hmm. candidates on the right. Number of reasons for that, but the basic premise or the truth of all this is that college professors are really good at a lot of things. They're really bad at permanently brainwashing our kids.
Yeah. You know, Barack Obama or the Obama administration is one of the villains of your book, yes? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's.
I mean, he's emblematic.
Statism and redistribution, and I take.
I mean, he's the effective leader. He's the Pope of the 30%ers, at least until the next election.
The Pope of the 30%ers. Yeah. I mean, I do take a lot of pretty strong shots at Republican
establishment
politicians.
We'll get to that in a second. But
I'm a nonpartisan critic of big government.
Yeah, and you've been a registered Democrat and Republican in your life, and you're now an independent.
Correct.
Okay, but. You know, is Obama actually against the free enterprise system, or is he he's called himself a redistributionist, at least in the famous clip with Joe the Plumber, but I mean, is he actually for getting rid of private property?
No. I mean, is he a full-blown card-carrying socialist? Of course not. You know, it's nonsense for us to be you know, too hyperbolic about this stuff. But let's keep in mind the way social democracy always works. I mean, virtually everybody in the United States who's a free marketeer believes that, you know, markets fail occasionally, and we actually need rule of law and a pretty smart government such that the free enterprise system can flourish. So what is the government supposed to do? And the answer is look at cases where market's failing, and it's even legitimate, according to Hayek, if you read back in The Road to Serfdom, even to provide a basic standard of living for folks. The problem is when we get into two other objectives. One is to say it's not fair for some people to earn so much more than others, to level for the sake of leveling, and number two is to take risk out of people's lives. You know, those are the two impulses of social democrats, and that's those are two core competencies that we see from statist and redistributionists since time immemorial.
Let's just push on this too. I mean, and where is that happening in Obama in terms of, is he saying that, you know, I'm going to cap CEO compensation? Or is it something? I mean, are you saying that it's a march of a long march where he says, okay, you know what, the bonuses that certain people got from Wall Street a couple of years ago, we're going to tax those, or we're going to try to tax those, and then they try and work it down?
It's effectively both. I mean, when you look at the whole idea of increasing marginal tax rates on families earning $250,000 and above, which is a pretty small percentage of Americans, and people in the Obama administration have been asked time and again, why do you want to do that? And Mr. Obama himself answered, because we need a sense of fairness and balance in our tax code. That's a redistributionist impulse. That's the idea that it's actually as important to bring the top down as it is to bring the bottom up.
And I guess here, you know, and I say this as somebody, we released a video about 2 weeks ago where Hillary Clinton had said something, you know, that it's about time for the rich to pay their fair share. And any way that you cut the data, the wealthy are paying much more than their share of income. They're paying, and the poor, the bottom 50%, are paying much less than their share of overall income and things like that. So the fairness issue seems a bit strange. But isn't it more that they believe that the rich can pay more it's not that they're not going to make Steven Spielberg, you know, down to our level or below by capping his taxes, but it's just that he can kick in extra.
Well, yeah, the rich can pay more, and they do pay more. They pay a lot more. The question is, how much more do you want to squeeze out of them? And almost certainly, we can squeeze more out of the rich, although, as we know, they're tremendously diminishing returns. Right. The rich tend to do really diabolical things like not creating businesses and not creating new jobs when you lower the incentives for them to do it.
Or getting, you know, even in non-loophole-based tax regimes, they somehow come up with a way where they can hide their income or shift it around.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, they'll follow the incentives. Right. And they'll avoid things mostly through completely legitimate means and because people don't want to have their income expropriated. Right. People don't like it. It's unpleasant. And it's unpleasant for lots of reasons, not just because of the money, but because people don't like their control taken away. So when you do that, when you actually, and you follow what economists have been teaching us for generations now, and the data tells it very clear that you get very little back when you just try to sock it to the mega wealthy, at least as defined by the administration. So why are you going to do it? And the answer is because that seems like a fairer system.
Or is it that softens the ground for raising taxes? Because then they say, we didn't get enough, we got to bring it down more because the government always wants more revenue. And so then they start taxing middle class people more.
Well, the middle class are ultimately going to have to pay. Yeah. I mean, they're simply, you can't get the arithmetic to work right. Mm-hmm. If when we're taking trillions and trillions of dollars from future generations, somebody's going to have to pay it. Right. It's the middle class that's got all the dough in this country.
Your book makes a clear distinction that what's going on under Obama is particularly bad, or it's on steroids. But it's also true that virtually all of your arguments, and in fact you make some of these arguments about the expansion of government spending and influence, could be applied to equal force with President Bush, who was feted at AEI in 2003, gave the talk at the annual dinner. But I mean, you note that it was Bush and with the help of a GOP Congress that created and rammed through TARP. Bailed out auto companies, regulated at a higher rate than Clinton. I mean, he gave us Sarbanes-Oxley, among other atrocities, increased overall government expenditures by about twice, 100%. He oversaw the prescription drug benefit in Medicare, which has no clear discernible benefit to anybody other than politically connected seniors. I mean, you can go on and on. He violated NAFTA just as Obama has and things like that. Why shouldn't we be talking about the 21st century as an era of the growth of big government, as opposed to talking about it in terms of a kind of 20th or 19th century model of right and left, that somehow there's some new shift now that Obama's in office, as opposed to, if we look at the past decade, it's statism any way you cut it?
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with that. In fact, one of the things that I say in the beginning of this book is we're fighting a culture war in this country, and this is not a culture war over God, guns, gays, and abortions. That's something from the 1990s. Important issues people care a lot about still, but that's not what we're fighting about. It's also not a culture war between Democrats and Republicans. This is a culture war between big government and us. I mean, these are the government doesn't exist to not do stuff. It's growing, and it's growing quickly, and there's a really alarming tendency for people with the reins of power to go native and use these tools to do more. That's why we have to remember that our culture is fundamentally centered on free enterprise. That when we start to forget that, then we start to acquiesce to all of the policies that we don't like.
And free enterprise is the economic application of a more generally kind of classically liberal project of the idea that the individual and the groups that they form cooperatively are really the source of meaning and significance in life.
Correct. I mean, that's what the whole idea of the pursuit of happiness in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence says, that we are autonomous individuals, that we should be able to pursue our happiness as we define it. It's a profoundly moral libertarian principle.
Why didn't you write The Battle in 2006 or in 2008?
That's when I started it. Okay. I mean, I started this project, but the dis-ease, the unease that Americans were feeling, you know, starting in 2006, where it was clear that, you know, we might say something about loving the free enterprise system, and our policymakers might say that, but we're clearly going down a road that does not respect it.
Who are the Republican malefactors who, either besides Bush, who destroyed or are destroying kind of free enterprise, or using it to cover an agenda that just gives them more power?
Well, there's been a problem just in general with the system in Washington, where you self-select politicians and you reward politicians with leadership in the Houses of Congress, where people are really good at appropriating resources for things that reward very narrow interests with rent-seeking behavior. So people who can bring home bailouts, people who are very effective at social engineering, and people who are especially good at pork barrel spending. Now, there are really courageous guys, men and women, on the Hill.
Can we name them?
Probably not. Yeah. We probably shouldn't. But you know,
why shouldn't
well,
we
because
name
it's
them?
Because you know the idea of sort of getting behind particular politicians. What I want to get behind is principles that can be applied to people of either political party. So as opposed to you know naming a you know a list of Republicans who I particularly like or dislike.
But aren't they the problem? Because they're the ones who are using the rhetoric of free enterprise to undermine the system. And I mean, you mentioned in the book, he's safe because I don't know if he's in prison or hiding under a rock somewhere, but somebody like Ted Stevens, the Alaska senator, who is a big government person, there's no question about it. But I mean, who are the players on the scene from either party who are actually advancing a free enterprise agenda in a way that seems credible and meaningful?
Well, there are people in the intellectual sphere. You know, the people that's what the think tank movement is supposed to do. The think tank movement is supposed to take the free enterprise agenda and resync it with the moral psyche of Americans to help them remember that their 70% values are not just some pie-in-the-sky rhetoric, that these things really do matter, that they can manifest themselves in real public policies in entitlement reform and tax reform and health reform or health re-reform or you know whatever we're all about these days. And then there are policymakers that could be rewarded for kind of rebellious leadership along these lines. And there are people in there. I mean, I will, here's Paul Ryan, is a congressman from Wisconsin, who completely shares the values that the founders had about the expression of freedom. And he believes this at the cultural level, not just because it's kind of convenient for getting elected in this district.
Right. Although he did vote for TARPA and the auto bailout.
He repudiates the auto bailout at this point.
Yes. Part of the point of the battle is to engage people and also to convince people either to fire up the 70% or help shrink the 30% a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And now, because of your position and because of AEI's situation in political discourse and whatnot, this one of the questions that comes forward is, you know, are these books written by people who are associated with organizations when they are in power as opposed to when they are out of power? And, you know, for instance, your book, it has a foreword from Newt Gingrich.
Right.
You have blurbs on the galleys from Dick Cheney, from Bill Bennett, from Marvin Alasky, who's not a politician but is a reliable right-wing conservative thinker.
Don't forget Karl Rove.
Okay,
he's
a
liberal,
Karl Rove.
Right?
No, he's off the reservation. But what I'm saying is that how do you reach out and how do you convince people then that this isn't just the way by which the Republican Party gets back into power and then does exactly what they did for the first 6 years of the 21st century, which was absolutely blow out all the stops on not just on government spending, but also on a lot of government policies, whether we're talking about warrantless wiretaps, whether we're talking about working around various kinds of civil liberties issues, arrogating to itself more and more power, including TARP, taking TARP money and illegally or extra-legally just funneling it to GM and to Chrysler. How do you convince... let me put it a little bit differently. A libertarian audience whose free enterprise bona fides are absolutely not in question, who have been sickened over what they saw of a Republican president, a Republican Congress, and even quite possibly a Republican Supreme Court.
Well, the way to do it is to remember why free enterprise matters and make that particular argument. And that argument cuts across political party. It cuts across the way that we define our ideology, and it goes straight to exactly why we care about freedom in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's the third chapter of this book. The third chapter of this book talks about why free enterprise matters to us as citizens, to us as people. And the answer to that is basically that the argument that income redistribution, that income equality leads to happiness is profoundly wrong, not as a philosophical matter, as an empirical matter. We have the data that show that what really makes people happy, what leads to higher levels of flourishing, and this is based on a lot of, 30 years of data from psychologists on human happiness.
And this is the meat of your project when you were a tenured academic. I mean, you covered this ground quite a bit.
Work on human happiness and the economics and public policy of human happiness. And one of the things that we find is that what motivates most Americans in their flourishing and what they say gives them the greatest happiness outside of the private institutions of faith, and family and such, is this concept of earned success. And by earned success, I mean the feeling that you are creating value in your life or the life of other people. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be denominated, it might be measured in dollars, or it might be measured in souls saved, or the success of your children, or people who feel more free in former dictatorships, mm-hmm. or whatever the heck happens to be. But earned success is really the coin of the realm for most people. So the key is, how do you get more of it? And the answer is not income redistribution. Right. Income redistribution spreads money around. Earned success brings flourishing. And that's the moral imperative of the free enterprise system.
But here, to go back to some earlier comments, I mean, is anybody in the Democratic Party or in the Obama administration or even a Michael Moore type, are they saying, you know what, we have to declare year one and equalize income? Or are they saying something more along the lines of what you also say, which in the book, which is that what people want is equality of opportunity? And in order to ensure equality of opportunity in a world where there are people who come from families making $100,000 or $1 million a year and people who make $10,000 a year, we have to take some of this income and give it to these people in the form of student loans, in the form of early education programs, nutritional programs, things like that. And that's a form of redistribution, but it's certainly not a radical egalitarianism.
Sure, and there is redistribution that happens in virtually any developed society.
Right.
I mean, we have a functioning state. We got to pay for a functioning state. One of the things that a functioning state does is that where people who are rich disproportionately pay for services that accrue to people who have less. And so, even if we have equal access to protection from the army, for example, the rich are disproportionately paying for that.
Sure.
So you could say that that's some sort of income redistribution, yet it forms the basis of some sort of safety and security. And that could be tracked back into equal opportunity. The problem is basically when we say it's not just getting enough money to pay for public schools so that people can learn equally, or we can have basic nutrition programs so that people are starting as fair as they possibly can, even if they have parents who are really poor or parents who are really negligent.
Right.
What we're talking about is when we say fairness and balance requires that the rich pay their fair share, notwithstanding what that does to economic efficiency, notwithstanding what that does to how free most people think it is. It's when we say, why do we have to tax away the inheritance of people? The reason we do that is because it's not fair that some people actually have more. We want to take it away by virtue of them dying. And, one man's equality of income is another man's equality of opportunity, but most Americans really get it. And here's the intuitive test. What actually is fair? This is a word that's been expropriated a lot by the radical left. Fairness means people having more equality of stuff, basically. So let's get more fairness and balance. We hear it over and over again. But when you ask most Americans, this is based on data, but just common sense as well, when you ask most Americans, what do you think is the fairest system? They'll say it's a system that rewards hard work and merit and excellence and penalizes free-riding corruption and laziness. Mm-hmm. That's the free enterprise system in a nutshell. It's the fairest system because of that. And as such, just income redistribution, income equalization, doesn't pass the laugh test when you think about it deeply.
I don't disagree with that in an American context or, in on a personal level. But I guess I'm curious, on page 101, you note, I wonder if you're making a slippage from, I think when people say equality of opportunity, it means that people should relatively have access to the same preparation for life, right? I mean, and that's not necessarily radical. And most people aren't saying everybody's got to go to Eton or, Lawrenceville Prep or something like that. But kids who grow up in crappy neighborhoods should have access to schools that are as good as kids who grow up in wealthy suburbs. But at one point you wrote, the 30% coalition twists equality of opportunity into equality of outcomes. They elevate money to the level of justice by saying that this must be equal to, as Karl Marx famously put it, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Or as President Obama put it almost as famously, when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody. Isn't that, from a persuasion, from a rhetorical perspective, isn't that inflammatory? Because it doesn't seem, who are you speaking to there, the 70%? Or the 30%.
I'm speaking to the 70% that needs to stop losing arguments.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to stop losing arguments for what they understand is true fairness. Look, we've got, you asked who the 30% coalition is before, and I told you about the 5% that are in idea industries. There's another 25 percentage points in there, and 15 of those percentage points are young people who keep hearing fairness, 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 and they love it because fairness sounds really good.
Right.
And the people on the political right, or the libertarians, the free marketeer, you and me, we get stuck talking about economic efficiency. So, they'll say, well, we want a fair system. and we'll say, but don't you understand that'll cut a quarter percentage point off long-term economic growth rates? And everybody just yawns because these guys aren't even paying taxes yet. We need to be making the moral argument, and that means actually stopping losing the arguments about this basic concept of fairness that, that goes around all the time. Now, you said there's a fine line between what one person sees as economic equality or income equality and what other somebody else sees as opportunity equality. That's the fight I want to have. That's the argument I want to have. And if, if look, if everybody in America agrees to repudiate the idea of income equality right now, then let's then we'll have a deep fight about what opportunity equality really means. And you know, I can take that.
One of the things that's interesting about the book is that you talk about you know, capitalism as a morally superior system because it gives rise or it allows people to pursue what they want to do. I mean, and that the, there's a moral dimension to that. It sounds very much like an Ayn Rand type of argument. That I mean, that was her basic argument. It's not an empirical one, although it's nice that everybody who makes the moral argument also points out and can point out historically that free markets, free enterprise tends to make everybody wealthier. So it's a win-win. But, you know, then you, you think about a lot of the people who are into free enterprise are not necessarily religious or don't have necessarily that same type of morality. And I'm thinking of what do you do to reach people in free enterprise? Gingrich introduced your book, and he's currently waging a war on what he calls Obama's secular socialist machine. But what is isn't free enterprise ultimately a secular pluralist project? If it is part of a liberal project where the idea of the state is not to create certain outcomes, but rather to create a framework of pluralism and tolerance where as many different types of people can pursue whatever experiments in living they prefer. So is there a real clash in the broadly construed right between kind of religious people and free enterprise people that always comes up against one another?
It's not irreconcilable at all.
Okay.
And part of the reason it's not irreconcilable is because we have to remember, why is the United States, whether we're religious or not, we have to recognize the United States is a pretty religious country.
Right.
And one of the reasons it is because we're a pluralist, tolerant place that doesn't establish religion constitutionally. One of the things that we know is that when you have a monopoly in telecoms, you get lousy, expensive telecom service. Well, when you have a monopoly in religion, you get lousy, expensive religious service. I mean, basically, the free market for souls is one of the big reasons that the United States is such a religious country. We have to understand that the free market system is a complement to people acting true to their own hearts.
So what happens, I think, you know, you talk a lot about American exceptionalism in the book, and in fact, the thing that's exceptional about America, or one of the things, is a lack of a state religion, and a fairly bread-in-the-bone tolerance of all sorts of religions, even Roman Catholicism, which you are a practicing member of. I was raised as, I was always taught in Catholic school early on about Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, and I never realized why, but it's because they were religious dissenters. And, you know, if you're a Catholic, you're generally in a minority in America, even if it's the single largest group. But, you know, the connection between free enterprise, people who have backed free enterprise and religious values. Gingrich is a great example who cannot, who won't separate out the two. I mean, to be free enterprise, you have to be Christian, you have to do this, you have to do that. He writes a lot, you know, I mean, the crossover is huge there. And yet you mentioned before that the culture battle that you're interested in is not about abortion, it's not about gays, it's not about guns. Do you agree with Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who recently said, you know what, in the Wall Street Journal of all places, we need, you know, fiscal conservatives need to declare a truce on social issues. They should go away. And he was roundly attacked by conservatives.
Yeah, well, he's not roundly attacked by all conservatives. And to be clear, Newt doesn't say to believe in free enterprise you have to be a Christian. I mean, I know that's a, that's a caricature of it. He doesn't say that. And he actually doesn't think that. What he understands is that there's a natural complementarity between people who have a very strong moral system, whether it be a religion or whether it's secular ethics or whatever it happens to be.
But it's not secular ethics.
Well,
because,
exactly.
I mean, he's hostile toward secularism.
Well, he's not hostile toward people that live true to a moral system, a moral code that creates virtue. Now, we can argue until the cows come home about virtue, but one of the things we do know is that people who don't pay attention to the concept of virtue have a very, very hard time functioning in the free market system because, you know, it is not that capitalism corrupts moral values.
Right.
It is that bad moral values corrupt capitalism. And so we actually need a society that has trust. We need a society that has some common values. And if the vehicle for that happens to be standard religious faith, that's great. We actually tolerate each other in the, and and we should actually embrace the fact that different people get to these values in different ways.
Here's one of you've hinted at that you're libertarian or you have libertarian impulses. How do you define yourself politically or ideologically?
I'm a political independent. I mean, I have very strong views about the free enterprise system. Mm-hmm. My three fundamental values are expanding liberty, increasing individual opportunity, and defending entrepreneurship.
One of the things that I'm thinking again in terms of persuasion and winning back, there's a, depending on who you talk to, there's anywhere from about a 10 to a 25% swing vote somewhere out there that is broadly libertarian. That means that they want limited government, more efficient government, smaller taxes, less regulation, and they're broadly socially liberal. They're tolerant. And one of the ways that groups coming out of a conservative background can win them back, and I'm not saying you should cut your views to this fashion or anything, but is that the people who are pushing free enterprise are not actually also then, you know, we want economic liberty, but social or civil liberty we're kind of upset by.
Yeah.
And, you know, with that as a background, I'm just asking, and it also seems like in your book you're struggling towards a new paradigm from a more conventional conservative point of view. Should gays be allowed to marry?
I think that we should support, you know, free contracts between mm-hmm. people as a matter of basic civil rights and rule of law. But I want to go back to one quick thing that you said. You equated social liberalism with tolerance. That's a mistake.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
That's a big mistake because
I
think
socially
that you should be socially as conservative as you want. You should still be tolerant. And that's the key to the whole thing,
right,
is tolerance of each other's views on issues that are truly unsettled. Mm-hmm. And remembering the thing that the bedrock of American culture, in my view, is the free enterprise system, is the workaday manifestation of the freedoms that our right. founders envisioned. And then we can work through a lot of these things that were traditionally part of the 1990s culture war.
So gays should be allowed to freely enter into contracts. Should heterosexuals not be allowed to get benefits from the state that are different than what a gay contract would be, a gay-to-gay contract?
I don't know the answer to that. This is exactly one of the battleground issues mm-hmm. that we're working through, that we should be able to work through, understanding that the free enterprise system, if it's abridged, won't let us even get to those conversations. Mm-hmm. Because when we can't get to those conversations, those answers will be decided for us by a basically omnipotent state, mm-hmm. which is exactly what we're trying to avoid. I actually want to have that argument, but we have to fight this first one first.
Yeah. Where does immigration fit into your scheme? Because at various points you talk about how free trade is good, and one of the problems with, and this is certainly true of the Obama administration, and in many ways following up on certain Bush policies that reduce trade or threaten to use trade mm-hmm. as a way of fighting kind of status battles.
Right.
Most people will say, that you have free goods coming across the Mexican border, that's great, but people, not so much. I mean, how does immigration fit into your worldview?
I think that every country has a right to decide how it wants to defend its borders, obviously, yeah. and so forth and so on. But my own personal view is that we're a country based on immigration. We're a country mm-hmm. based on the idea of cross-fertilizing our population with people who actually are entrepreneurial enough to want to come here. And, you know, we risk that at our great national peril. I mean, there's actually a growing body of research that says that Americans are genetically different than people in other parts of the world because you put your capital at risk most radically when you pick up and you move. You put your intellectual, social, religious, and financial capital at risk when you go someplace where you don't know anybody, you don't have a job, you don't speak the language. This is a really big deal. And if we're self-selecting something that's a mutation in other countries and making it the norm in our country, you're going to cut that mm-hmm. off? I mean, this is really the essence of our free enterprise spirit, in my view. I'm very pro-immigration because I think that it's not just it's a question of fairness and it's a question of freedom. I think it's actually our soul.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You write positively of the American military and of military spending in general. And military spending tends to be the largest single budget item in the discretionary part of the federal budget. And yet, if we know anything about government spending, and military spending seemingly in particular, is very inefficient. There's a lot of waste built in. What are the ways that we make sure that we're getting the military that we pay for, that we need, and not a lot of other stuff?
Well, this the idea of accountability in government and accountability that's imposed on government from citizens is something we should, mm-hmm. not just in military spending, we should be asking for that in the way that we build parks, the way mm-hmm. that we... You know, we teach our kids as opposed to pouring all the dough into teachers' unions. Right. I mean, these are basic accountability questions about the government. We can't stop doing that. We can't stop doing that just because patriotism and military strength are involved either.
Right.
We should not morally stand for the government wasting the hard-earned, honestly earned resources right. of its people. So how do we do that? Well, there are a lot of policies that are actually trying to push us toward greater accountability, and they tend to be truncated when the government is in full growth mode. In other words, when the government's core competency is getting bigger, we have very, very little impulse. Your views about military spending notwithstanding, you have right. very, very little impulse to figure out how you can use the money better.
If you have a bottomless well.
Exactly right. I mean, a budget constraint is very helpful for that. Then we can start making constrained decisions.
AEI was, not only was widely known, but touts itself as a powerful force in pushing for the invasion of Iraq. On the website, in one article, it reads, AEI has taken a leading role in defining the threat that Saddam poses and outlining how Iraq should be reconstructed once he is removed. It's got a list of articles. Do you think the invasion of Iraq was necessary, and how would you fit that into a larger vision of American military power? Because this is also, again, it's not the free enterprise somewhat, although it was often yoked within the Bush administration where free enterprise and were for a muscular foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, are these things necessarily linked, or is that a problem in and of itself?
I don't think it's a problem in and of itself. I mean, one of the core competencies of the state is public goods,
right.
and a standing army and defense and a muscular defense
right.
and power projected around the world, if that's your cup of tea, mm-hmm. can absolutely be apprehended within the context of the public good. So if that's the case, and I think it is in the case of how we project power around the world, it makes sense to pay
so
attention.
So Iraq, good idea, bad idea? Was it a good idea, poorly executed, good idea, well executed, bad idea, well executed?
On balance, good idea, poorly executed. Ultimately, there was a course correction that led to far, far higher levels of success in Iraq. Now, once again, there are a couple of sleights of hand in there. You have to agree with me on a couple of things, and reasonable people don't agree on all these things. So what I'm suggesting is that freedom, as understood in the United States, is, I feel, AEI's gift to America and mm-hmm. America's gift to the world. And you share that gift to the world in different ways. Now, some people would say never, never, never with military power, and other people would say that when you actually have allies like Israel and like South Korea and like Taiwan, there are cases in which there are threats to that, threats to our allies,
right.
and indeed threats to free people around the world that have to be met.
Okay. What about, are you comfortable with Obama's foreign policy? I mean, in many ways, which is following a Bush withdrawal strategy from Iraq, as well as also a refocusing on Afghanistan, which just seemed to kind of languish once the trail on bin Laden went cold.
There's not a lot of indication that the civil ordering in Iraq is supporting the successes the American military has had, and that's actually a big threat to the region. We don't want to take one dictatorship and then have military success and have some years hence have another dictatorship in its place, because that actually wouldn't serve the moral purposes that we have. But it's also in Afghanistan, it's a very complicated picture. It's clear that there were some correct decisions and some incorrect decisions that were made, and we're in the middle of, I think, a pretty alarming set of data that tell us that the Obama administration is not really following what it said it was going to.
Can you think of an American military intervention that was not justified?
An American military intervention that was not justified? Off the top of my head, it was. People at my colleagues at AEI and disagree violently about how different. How Bosnia was executed, mm-hmm. how Somalia was executed, how even certain acts in Panama and Grenada were mm-hmm. executed. Were they the right things to do? Once the die was cast, the United States needs to win.
Well, that's a different thing.
Indeed.
Right? Yeah,
indeed. But all of these things are actually open to question. And indeed, mm-hmm. the day we don't have these interventions open to question is a day that we start making mm-hmm. terrible, terrible policy errors.
I think in the book you mentioned at one point that there is... We're overdue as a country for a discussion about foreign policy. I mean, one thing that you can say about the Cold War period is that there was, in fact, whether you agreed with it or not, there was a consensus between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. I mean, case in point is that John F. Kennedy was much more hawkish than Richard Nixon in 1960, but they were both in the same kind of general camp. What will AEI do to help kind of produce or foment that next discussion about an actual post-Cold War, post-9/11 foreign policy?
Well, the AEI in a lot of places where we share values about the way we think people can flourish best need to actually try to get some consensus on this in the United States, such that we, as we project this, as we talk to people around the world, we can defend those ideas, we can defend those ideals where they do exist, and as aggressively as we need to, particularly as they threaten our ideals inside the United States. That doesn't have to be the difference between Democrats and Republicans. And, and as you just pointed out, it hasn't traditionally been the difference between Democrats and Republicans.
Well, talk a bit about both your hopes for the book in terms of reaching out to Democrats, but then also AEI, which again is widely recognized as a Republican-leaning think tank. I mean, you have... the people there are mostly Republican. The tighter kind of political connections are to the Republicans. How do you reach out to Democrats, or what's in it for them at this point to sign on to your kind of prescriptions for free enterprise and for other visions of America?
Well, from a political perspective, the freedom agenda is going to win. And the freedom agenda is going to win because we've been ratcheting it away from it, and there's rebellion in the United States today, and the rebellion is against... the forces that are stripping away the primary outlet for human flourishing, which is the earned success system. Now, if anybody who wants to win will actually look at the cultural currents, and the cultural currents are toward full rebellion against a lot of Americans see as a road to serfdom. So that's a winning formula for Democrats. That's a winning formula for Republicans. It's a winning formula for people who really embrace American values.
You talk towards the end of the book about how what we should be interested in are principles, not power. How that always sounds good, and you can always convince the politician right up to the moment they take office. How do you hold them accountable?
Well,
to principle and not power.
Well, that starts with a couple of different things. One is ideas. That comes from Reason, that comes from AEI, that comes from organizations that share a common cause in the free enterprise system. And that means with these ideas, making them into realistic policy prescriptions that actually can win because there are Americans like them a lot. Once politicians have policies that they can grab onto, then they're more likely to embrace them. And once they've lashed themselves at the mast, they're more likely to do the right thing. But that starts with us. That starts with us and the intellectual infrastructure to come up with ideas that can win. Any campaign, the campaign for free enterprise or politics or war or anything, has three elements to it. Number one is making the moral case, saying this is the right thing to do and in your heart it's true. The second is demolishing bad ideas, bad things, and the third is putting good things in their place. So we have to be able to put the good things in their place. That's a critical thing to keep in mind. The second thing is, of course, reminding Americans that principles matter more than political power, which they manifestly agree with, and reminding Americans that as they compromise one little bit, one little policy at a time, they get away from the very principles that they actually hold most dear. When Americans understand that, they tend to hold politicians accountable.
Let's talk a little bit about your kind of personal ideology or intellectual journal. You were a professional musician for many years. You play the French horn.
I did.
And all over the place, right?
Yeah. I actually didn't make it quite through 1 year of college when I was 18 by sort of mutual... conclusion of the college and me. We went our separate ways, and I joined a chamber music group and traveled around the United States, visited all 50 states playing chamber music, and I joined the Barcelona Symphony in Spain for several years.
And then somehow you came back to school and you became a professor. Your degrees are from institutions outside the typical realm of think tank heads, I think. Thomas Edison College in New Jersey, which is one of the first nation's first distance learning outfits, right? Florida Atlantic University, and then RAND Corporation's Public Policy Program. How did you end up rebooting back into an academic life, and what was driving you to do that?
Well, I actually was in relatively non-traditional academic institutions because I was trying to make my living as a musician at the time, and I was on the road constantly, so I needed a flexible kind of learning method. And this is one of the great promises of the free enterprise system. You don't find things like this where the government decides how everybody's going to learn. It's extraordinary, that we have this kind of flexibility in the United States. It's actually a miracle. It was pretty inevitable that I would have some sort of academic. Academia is kind of a vortex. My father was a math professor. My mother was an artist, also an academic. My grandfather was an academic. And so you kind of get sucked into it. I always figured that at some point I'd be more involved in the university. And I spent 10 years as a university professor before coming to AEI.
Right. And what Talk a little bit about your academic background. You taught at Georgia State as well as Syracuse.
Right.
And what was driving you? Why did you want to become a professor other than you wanted to make mom and dad feel good?
Well, mom and dad didn't feel good. They were angry with me until the end of their lives that I had actually left the French horn business. But this is a perfect example of how free enterprise manifests differently across generations. I was going to leave the music business. I'd been in the Barcelona Symphony and making a good living. And I went to my dad and said, I'm going to go back to graduate school. I'm going to get a PhD. And I thought he was going to say, great, because he had a PhD. And he said, why are you going to do that? You have a great job. And I said, but I don't like my job. And he said, so what makes you so special?
Right.
I mean, basically, everybody hates their job as far as my dad was concerned. But I went back to, I wanted to learn more. As a matter of fact, when I was in the music business and I was tooling around, I was kind of doing a bachelor's degree and studying economics, I happened across this book about welfare reform by Charles Murray and another one he had written called The Bell Curve. It was really subversive stuff. It was kind of forbidden at the time to read this this right-wing literature. Of course, I read it because I had authority problems. And I read these books by Charles Murray, and it just rocked my world. I said, this is the cleverest stuff I've ever seen. I actually went back to graduate school because I started reading the work of AEI scholars, never knowing that this is where the path would lead.
All right, to talk about your personal intellectual journey, one of the things that's interesting is losing ground is all about how what matters are not the individuals in a system, but rather the system, and so that smart people and dumb people will follow the incentives the same way. And the bell curve seems to be making the exact opposite point, which is that you can't help people very much. So what where does that leave you in a kind of are you a Charles Murray losing ground or a Charles Murray bell curve person?
It's both. I mean, if we had Charles here, he would say no, there's a lot more connective tissue between those two things. He would say that what really matters is the autonomy of the individual and how and individuals can be thrown about in a sea that simply rewards particular personal characteristics.
But the determinants of the autonomy are genetic. Right, are not able to be ameliorated by environment.
No. But the bell curve says that there's a non-trivial part of our cognitive life that's wired, but something like half isn't, and that culture really matters a lot. And in fact, when we have a class system, a ruthless class system that only sorts on the one thing that's wired, we get all kinds of terrible outcomes.
Well,
we need to be masters of ourselves. And masters in our public policy to make sure that we do really reward individuals in their individual richness, which is a terrifically libertarian point.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no question that Murray is a libertarian at all.
Not a question.
He's written a book about it. Who are your other intellectual heroes or your personal heroes?
James Q. Wilson has been my mentor since I was in graduate school. He actually sat in on my dissertation defense, and for some reason, I mean, my dissertation was about the economics for symphony orchestras. I mean, it was just. But he got interested in it.
So it was a very short book.
It was a refutation of the axiom that brevity is the soul of wit.
Right.
It was brief but not witty. And nobody's dissertation is funny, believe me. But he actually said it on and said, you might do something interesting. We stayed in touch. He was very helpful on early books.
So what do you pull out of him?
James Q. Wilson is the sort of the sine qua non of the use of social science, of empirical social science for the good of individual people. And the whole idea that people matter, that individual people matter, and that social science leads you to conclusions that are not for a growing state and a nanny state that suffocates individuals, but on the contrary, it'll illuminate how the richness of our differences and can lead us to behave differently, to help us understand how our personality differences and our relationship to the state matters a lot for our flourishing. I mean, other people that I love a lot are Irving Kristol, Milton Friedman, Hayek. These are the people who.
What do you like about Hayek?
What I love about Hayek is his nuanced. I mean, Hayek. It's you read The Road to Serfdom, which every single person watching this has got to go read The Road to Serfdom again. I mean, everybody's read it, of course. But it's this fresh.
But
today.
They've read it like they've listened to Sgt. Pepper's or something.
You mean high?
Or like long ago, and I never want to do it again. Right.
It was written 66 years ago, and it looks like it was. It sounds like it was written last Thursday. I mean, it's practical, it's interesting, it's provocative, it's moral. It's basically all of the things that we want to be as intellectuals. It's a wonderful. It's a wonderful piece of work, and a lot of people who watching this will read it and say, it's too. It's too soft. Mm-hmm. He says that a basic standard of living is okay because. A lot of libertarians are harder over on these issues, but it's extremely provocative for helping us understand, what our worldview really is. And I mean, it's such path-breaking work. It's great.
Who is your favorite musician?
My favorite composer, and this is a hard thing to answer when you're a classical musician,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Because you've got the creators and you've got the recreators, right?
That's right.
So I go straight to the creators. My favorite composer is Anton Bruckner.
And why is that?
Anton Bruckner is, he is the embodiment of what was best in the Romantic period, building on everything that had come before it. That said, if I have 2 minutes to kill, it'll always be with Bach.
And why Bach?
Bach, because it's just right all the time.
Just right. That sounds like the Outback Steakhouse. I don't know.
Yeah, well,
just
it's actually,
right all the time.
Bach is actually a more successful franchise.
You wrote a lot about optimism in your work, and we can end on this note. You know, and optimism in your life's work, including the battle. According to Wikipedia, you have three kids, and you may have been involved in the Kennedy assassination. I think that gets thrown into everybody's...
Wikipedia said three. That could be anywhere between one and 30.
That's right, or none at all.
Yeah.
But do you, speaking of optimism, do you think they will have a better life than you?
I believe that my children have the opportunity based on their, based on our culture and their behavior to have a better life than I do. And I think that part of it is up to me, but a large part it's up to them. And I think that there's a non-trivial likelihood. Most people actually do advance economically. Some people do advance socially. And given the promises of our system, the miracle of our system, they actually have a fighting chance to make it a reality.
Has there ever been a time where that wasn't true?
In the United States?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there have been periods in which, because of dire economic circumstance or because the free enterprise system hadn't become fully manifest, that there were, I mean, if you look economically, there were periods of relative stagnation. I mean, there were, you know, one generation wouldn't expect to be meaningfully richer or meaningfully more prosperous in non-wealth ways than their parents.
And we certainly think that now. How would you rate the threat level that if government continues on the, you know, the 21st century has been pretty disappointing so far. I would stand by that estimation. But if the next 90 years are like the last 10, are your kids going to live better or worse than you?
Well, once again, the main element at their disposal is not the exogenous economic system. It's not what the government gives them. It's not even what the economy gives
them.
Well,
the government prevents them.
It's up to them. I mean, it's really, it has to do with their motivation, the way that they treat their liberty, the individual opportunity that they take from the system ultimately, and their entrepreneurial impulse. These are the things that I'm trying to inculcate as a father. Incidentally, Wikipedia is correct in this case. I do have three.
Yes.
And they're pretty entrepreneurial. I mean, that's really what I want to give them. That's what I want them to remember, is that the future is to a very, very large extent in their hands, and not to think that they're a victim, that they're not actually simply tossed in the seas of our culture and our economy.
Or even their genetics, obviously.
Not even their
genetics. Have no doubt... you know, bequeath them an endless number of defective genes and thoughts and things like that.
Fortunately, my wife makes up for that a lot. One of my kids is adopted. Okay. And, you know, going outside the gene pool is something I highly recommend.
Well, I want to thank Arthur C. Brooks, author of The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future, also the president of the American Enterprise Institute, for talking to Reason TV today. Very much a
lot
of fun.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.